week of January 30th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 90, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Dublin, Ireland, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Liberty Square in the heart of Cairo, I'm Michael Gills.
You're not really in Cairo.
No, I'm not. But you're really in Ireland.
Yes, I am really in Ireland. Yes.
I wish I were in Ireland or Liberty Square. It's very exciting. What are you doing in Ireland?
I am working with an entertainment technology company on one of their projects and consulting with them on some new software applications they're working on.
Why do you have to be there in person?
You know, sometimes it pays to actually meet face-to-face and review everything.
That's true.
And it's speaking of reviewing, on today's show, we're going to be reviewing the Sundance Film Festival. IndieWire's Ann Thompson is going to be joining us. The Sundance Film Festival just ended this past weekend, and hopefully she can stick around for a discussion on the SAG and DGA awards, which occurred over the weekend. We'll also tell you about a new video streaming service that Amazon seems to be working on. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Okay, and the number one film at the box office this weekend was The Exorcist, starring Anthony Hopkins.
Did you somehow teleport back to 1970?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's The Rite, starring Anthony Hopkins. It just seems like The Exorcist, but it grossed $15 million. Number two is No Strings Attached, starring the Queen of Hollywood, Natalie Portman, at $13.6 million. That's at $40 million total. At number three is The Green Hornet, which is still holding pretty well. That made $11.5 million for $78 million total. Not exactly blockbuster status, but it'll probably scrape its way to $100 million. At number four is The Mechanic, which also grossed $11.5 million. That's a cheapo movie that CBS picked up, starring, of course, Jason Statham. And number five is The King's Speech, the frontrunner for the Oscar, which exploded at the box office. It grew about 40%. It's for the first time ever, it's grossed more than $10 million. It grossed $11.1 million. It's at $72 million total. It's the classic example of a movie capitalizing perfectly on Oscar nominations. And number six is True Grit, another big Oscar hopeful. That's at $7.6 million and at about $150 million total. And number seven is The Dilemma, the Ron Howard comedy, at $5.4 million. And number eight is the other Natalie Portman film, the drama Black Swan, which grossed $5.1 million, and it's at $90 million total and about to pass $100 million. And number nine, The Fighter, another Oscar hopeful, at $4 million. Number 10, Yogi Bear, 11, Tron Legacy, 12, Tangled, and 13, Little Fockers. You were traveling, so I'm certain you didn't see any movies this weekend.
Well, I saw a whole bunch of them on the plane.
Oh, what did you see?
I saw The American.
Uh-huh.
And there was one more, Going the Distance, that Justin Long, Drew Barrymore film.
So you were trying to put yourself to sleep, or?
I was trying, yes, desperately.
Well, you picked the right movies. The Rite, of course, is an original film, but it's absurdly familiar copy of The Exorcist. I mean, right down to the older veteran priest, the younger priest who doubts his faith. I mean, it just looks like such a carbon copy of The Exorcist. It's actually a fairly big opening for Anthony Hopkins for any movie other than the Hannibal Lecter films. It's his biggest opener ever, I believe.
Well, I guess the same could be said about The Mechanic, which is one of Jason Statham's bigger openings.
Yeah, it's not his biggest, but yeah, he's right there in the $10 to $50 million range most of the time. So that's good news for him. And it only costs, I think, CBS $15 million to pick up, so they'll make their money on it. And it's another great weekend for the Oscar hopefuls. They're all making great money and being seen, and this has to be one of the best years ever for audience interest in the Oscars. Other than like one huge blockbuster, which often happens, you've got, you know, four or five movies that are in the hunt for big awards. All of them are going to win something. The Fighter will win something. Black Swan will probably get a tech award, maybe Best Actress. The King's Speech will win big. True Grit might win Best Cinematography. So everybody is, and of course, The Social Network is out on DVD. So they're all, you know, in the mix and being seen by audiences. It could really have a good effect on the ratings.
Well, it even had a good effect on Tangled. I mean, yes, it dropped 18%, but it also dropped 271 theater locations, and it's up to $190 million.
That's right. It's going to make about $200 million. It had such a long, convoluted history that this Disney film cost $260 million to make by some estimates. But the actual cost for this movie, if they just started to make it from scratch, probably aren't that high, though animated films are very expensive. But Tangled's made a lot of money overseas, and it definitely is the most successful Disney movie outside of since The Lion King, really, or Tarzan, certainly. And other than Pixar movies, it's by far their best creative and commercial hit in a long, long time.
Right. And that $190 million, of course, is only in the United States.
Yeah. It's made a lot more overseas.
Well, some movies that didn't cost $260 million, at least not that I know of, and some movies that we'll probably be talking about in the box office segment later this year and into next year, played at this past year's Sundance Film Festival, which is the largest film festival in the United States, and it's one that features independent film for the most part. Of course, this year I didn't make it to the Sundance Film Festival, but we are joined now by Ann Thompson of IndieWire, and Thompson on Hollywood is her blog on IndieWire, and of course, she's also one of the co-hosts of Oscar Talk, and Ann was at Sundance, and I could swear 24 hours a day there was either something on Twitter about Sundance coming from Ann or a post going up on Thompson on Hollywood. And thank you for taking time to join us.
Yeah, you know, it was really a great festival and impossible to keep up with. And I'm happy to share my meager gleanings. I mean, I was running around like crazy, you know, looking at movies and doing interviews and posting, trying to keep up with the volume of news on, you know, so many movies there that sold, you know, and you know, the movie Like Crazy, which everybody raved about and won the jury prize at the end, I never even saw because I was just, you know, doing interviews and panels and things.
Yes, but to be clear about it, if you didn't see it, you made sure that someone in the Thompson family saw it, didn't you?
Oh, my daughter went to see it and loved it. She was helping me out with video editing up there. And I think she had a better list of movies than I did. She saw that. She saw Homework. She really liked that, too. That was also picked up. And it was a romance. And she really responded to it, as did a lot of other people. Paramount picked that one up.
Now, Felicity Jones won the Best Actress Award for that film. And she seems to be a bit of a discovery, as are Elizabeth Olsen, who is, I guess, the sister of the Olsen twins, and Anton Yelchin.
Well, we know Anton from Star Trek, you know, Mr. Zulu. No, he didn't play Mr. Zulu. He played the Russian character, Chekhov. And he's really been on a lot of people's radars for a while. But Felicity Jones, I discovered in The Tempest, the Julie Taymor film, and I thought she just popped. And she's got a lot of other things coming up. The casting people know who a lot of these people are before we discover them at Sundance.
Well, now, did you come home with any films in your pocket that you may have picked up for distribution? Because it seems like if you were at Sundance, you probably wound up buying a film or two, because at least 27 deals were made, from Fox Searchlight buying 4 to IFC buying 5, the Weinstein Company. I guess they brought My Idiot Brother. And they brought 2 films for a total of $14 million.
They had to pay more than everybody else.
Well, I mean, they have that reputation.
They bought
don't
world they? Rights, too. I'm being slightly sarcastic.
But now Roadside Attraction, they bought 3 films, and they also purchased Winter's Bone last year.
Yeah, and they have very good taste, and they are really great marketers. And in the end, they got the theatrical on the very good Project Nim from James Marsh, the guy who did Man on Wire, which is one of my favorite films there, one of many great docs. They picked up The Future, the Miranda July movie, which I loved. I think it was probably my favorite movie that I saw there. So, I mean, some of the movies that are, you know, some of the questions people have, you know, are these films going to be Oscar contenders later on? I'm not sure from what I see that's necessarily the case this time. With The Kids Are All Right and Winter's Bone, that was very, very clear. But we'll have to see how these movies play out in actual release to see what happens to them Oscar-wise.
Do you think that a lot of the purchasing and acquisitions up in Park City this year was due to the fact that Winter's Bone, The Kids Are All Right, all of these films, and Precious the year before, all of these films started at Sundance, so people were kind of nervous about missing the next big indie film?
I have a whole new thesis about this, and that is that back in the day when there wasn't as much money around, people became kind of, you know, used to look at pickups as the sort of safe thing to do, because, you know, if you actually go into production and make movies, that's risky. You know, you never know how they're going to turn out. It's a lot easier to go to a festival and find a movie and grab it. And you had a lot of different distributors this year needing to fill their slates, needing to have movies. And the Weinstein Co. has obviously shifted its strategy to picking up more movies instead of making as many as they were. Clearly, Searchlight was in the mood to buy if they picked up four things. Sony Pictures Classics admitted that usually they have, you know, something like 18 movies to release in a given year. They only had eight slated for 2011, and they bought a whole bunch. They bought two films before the festival, and then they kept buying. So, and I'm sure they're going to keep buying as we go into the future. Just to have that many deals in the course of the festival, competing late night auctions, it was like the old days. And
by old days, you mean like the late 90s?
Yeah, no, it was like, I mean, for people to be throwing around $7 million deals was, you know, we thought those days had long gone.
But most of the deals looked like they were in the sane realm. They looked like they were for the, you know, six figures or very low seven figures.
Most of them are. And IFC, as you know, has an enormous appetite for films because they're putting so many out in the course of a year straight to VOD. And they're not necessarily looking for the kind of big theatrical play that some of the other people do.
Well, they picked up a documentary titled Buck, which won the Documentary Audience Award, and it was one of those films that even not attending the festival, you read about in numerous reports. It is about the real-life horse whisperer.
And it was a particular favorite of Robert Redford, so it's not surprising that Sundance Selects ended up picking this up. And, you know, this was the guy. Apparently, this guy was actually on the set of The Horse Whisperer and solved the movie itself, the man who is Buck. You know, it was more than just the story of someone who could handle horses. It was about his own past and how he was damaged and how he was abused. And so he was unwilling to abuse horses and train them. It's very moving.
Well, did you see How to Die in Oregon, which won the Grand Jury Prize, which is a documentary?
Yet again, I did not.
Well, this is a movie that I guess in Oregon, euthanasia is somewhat legal. I think it is legal. And they documented a bunch of terminally ill people in Oregon, and it must have been a powerful movie because it I read about it before the awards ceremony, and it wound up winning the Grand Jury Prize.
Well, stepping back, and you go every year, tell us, how did this year feel overall creatively and commercially? From the outside, it looked like it was an incredibly productive year.
I couldn't agree more. Sorry to step on you there. It was an embarrassment of riches. I think that John Cooper and his team are doing a great job. I think the quality, a lot of people said this too, that another reason why the buying was so rigorous was because the quality of the films was there. And so what's happened in the indie marketplace is one of the things that really excited me a lot was seeing, for example, the team of Mike Cahill and Britt Marling on Another Earth, which Fox Searchlight picked up, and then this other film she had a second film that she also worked on as a co-writer, as a producer, as a star. She was an investment banker. It was sort of like a paradigm shift that you could just see inside this particular story. She was obviously a beautiful woman, an investment banker, very smart, from Georgetown. She ditched her job. She gave up all the money that would have been promised, you know, in the future, and she started making movies. And both of her films got into Sundance and did very well, and she's got a whole career ahead of her now.
Now Another Earth was one of them. What is this film about?
Another Earth is this movie that is very straightforward and accessible and simple, really. It's like a high concept movie where this young woman on the verge of going to MIT looks out the window and sees a planet. She was going to be an astrophysicist. A planet has suddenly popped into the sky, and she's looking out the window driving in the dark, and suddenly slams into another car and kills a little boy and the mom, the wife, and this guy survives, played by Willem Mapother. She goes to jail and comes out, and it has the sci-fi component of the fact that there's this other planet that's like a double of Earth, and the idea that all of us are all up there on that planet. And then it also has this, you know, she gets to know the man whose family she destroyed, and there's a romance that emerges. So there's all sorts of, it's just a very well made project, you know. And Mike Cahill, the director, is also going on to a rosy future. But they did it for nothing. They shot it in little houses that friends of theirs and her mother's house, and they didn't wait for permission to get started on this. They just went and did it. And there were a lot of projects like that. This other one called Resurrect Dead. The guy got into Sundance. He'd been rejected from other festivals. He was working as a house cleaner.
Wow.
To fund this documentary over 5 years, John Foy from Philadelphia, and he didn't have the money to get into, you know, to pay the fee, the entrance fee to Sundance. And a friend of his, Doug Block, you know, put him up on Kickstarter, raised the money, and he ended up winning a directing prize at Sundance.
But isn't that what Sundance is really all about?
It has become more about that. And in the age of this kind of DIY filmmaking, which we all hear so much about, you suddenly see that a smart kid with a camera can get into Sundance, basically.
Yeah. And another big factor for me seems to be that the major studios have shuttered most of their, you know, indie film shingles. And so they're out of the business of trying to pick up movies for $5 or $8 million and turn them into $100 million winners. It seemed that it was more about independent cinema and smaller companies all over the place now.
There was a range. What was really interesting about it is, of course, what you just said is perfectly true. But Paramount, the one that picked up like crazy, which was clearly the most successful film that showed there, it seems to be in the indie business nonetheless, even though they shuttered. They never completely got rid of Vantage, and they have this other thing called InSurge. And while it's a little bit vague what they want to do and who does what, they picked up like crazy. And what they did was to ingest some of the best people from DreamWorks, some of the best people from Vantage, and they are equipped to do what the studios used to do, which is release anything, you know? And it doesn't have to be from an indie arm anymore. And I found that sort of interesting. And there are also new distributors like Film District, which has Bob Burney and Peter Schlesel, and also Relativity now is a distributor. And there was a movie that I really didn't think was that good called Devil's Double. Which,
this is the movie about Saddam Hussein's son's body double.
Yeah, and it's both parts are played. It's sort of like The Prince and the Pauper, you know. Both parts are played by a very good young actor who was in An Education, Dominic Cooper, and he doesn't know, you know, he's fine. But the movie is Lee Tamahori's bid for a comeback, and it's very stylish and very overwrought, I thought. But Relativity was supposedly chasing that one and a few other things, so we'll hear some more deals.
Where's Freddie Bartholomew when you need him?
Ready to play Little
exactly. Prince and the Pauper. And of course, the capper to it all is Harvey Weinstein in there making big deals for two big movies. He's at Sundance when The King's Speech sweeps the Oscar nominations. And the New York Times runs a story on him saying he's back and describing him as a bottom feeder. I'm not quite sure where that came from, but it wasn't even a quote. They just said Harvey Weinstein, the bottom feeder.
Well, you know, he's one of the great things about him is that he's an enthusiastic, I'm not the first one to bring this up. I mean, he reminds a lot of people of the old moguls in the old days who had may have had great taste and may have had a great appetite for making amazing movies, but they were also sort of scruffy and not as classy as you would want them to be.
Harvey Weinstein is in that
category.
Oh, Harvey Weinstein is definitely scruffy. He is, of course, the head of the Weinstein Company and was the co-founder of Miramax.
These many years ago. And he's going to be making more movies with the new people who bought Miramax from Disney. He's going to be doing a bunch of sequels with them.
Yes, to Shakespeare in Love, which seems like such the sequel movie.
He has to make a living now. There's no room for error, and new people are basically commanding the financing of his company, and so he's on point. He can't make any mistakes anymore.
But overall, John Cooper, his second year as the program director and the head of the festival, it seems, at least from afar and from what you're saying, it was a really great year up at Sundance.
No question. And one of the other high points, by the way, in a first, was they showed at the big theater at the Eccles simultaneously and on YouTube, the movie that Ridley Scott produced called Life in the Day, with Kevin MacDonald directed, which was made up of submissions of short videos from all over the world, all shot on July the 24th. And the movie was wonderful, just wonderful.
National Geographic picked that up, so it should be in theaters later this year.
It will be.
And Red State was picked up by Kevin Smith. Were you at that screening?
I eschewed the screening of the Kevin Smith movie because he has gone on record many times now saying that he doesn't think critics are important, are an important part of the process of releasing movies. And part of what he's trying to prove here is that he can take a movie directly to his fan base, and which has been loyal over the years in a way that critics have not. And he has a very thin skin and does not like the way some people have reviewed some of his less appreciated films. And he does not want or nor does he want to seek out any kind of media coverage. So I'm out of there.
Well, and the funny thing is he got more media coverage by doing what he did than if he would have just let critics see his film.
He's pretty canny and sharp, and that fan base does exist, and he's been working it online for a lot of time, a lot of years now. So I'll be very curious to see. It'll be a service deal. I mean, he'll have to pick up the usual people to handle the video and the theatrical and so forth. But I think he also wants to collect the rewards. You know, it's a dangerous, risky way to go, but he's willing to give it a try.
Well, speaking of rewards, or at least awards, there were two awards ceremonies over the past weekend. One was the Screen Actors Guild Awards, which the King's Speech came out of looking pretty good. They won the Outstanding Performance by a Cast and Best Actor Colin Firth for King's Speech. That was kind of expected. Do you think at this point The Social Network is not necessarily done, but it does not have as much momentum, and really it's the King's Speech Oscar to lose at this point?
The word momentum is absolutely the right word to use, because what happens in these races is, you know, at the very beginning, you try to figure it all out in advance and say, this is what's going to happen. And then at the very end, you try to see which way the winds are going to shift in just the last couple of weeks. What matters between now and the 21st of this month is what will Academy voters actually put on their ballots, right? And so the late momentum is definitely now with the King's Speech, which got more nominations than any other film, 12, and just won the ensemble. And on the DGA, Tom Hooper, very surprisingly, the King's Speech director, won the DGA. So you have a situation where suddenly the momentum has totally shifted to the King's Speech. Now, I happen to have predicted this all along.
That's right, yes.
and sort of stuck to my guns when The Social Network was winning all the critics' awards and all the critics' media prizes, and people were just saying, oh, that's a lock, that's a lock. And it was too early to say that. And B, you have to look at the guilds. You have to see, because they are much, much more reflective of what the actual Academy voters are going to do. So it's going to be hard when the WGA comes on Saturday, because Seidler, the King's Speech writer, is not eligible for a WGA. So someone else will probably get that. I will bet that King's Speech wins Best Picture, and that Social Network gets a few key races, including possibly Best Director. By the way, I actually think that's possible, that Fincher could actually win Best Director, and the King's Speech could win Best Picture, and Sorkin will definitely win Adapted Screenplay.
Well, that's a pretty good bet, because it's nice to win the Boston Film Critics Award, but it's meaningless as far as the Oscars are concerned. Now that we have guilds that actually vote in the Oscars, naming their best films of the year, you have pretty much a clean sweep. The Producers Guild Award, the DGA, and the SAG Award have all gone to the King's Speech. And since 1995, when SAG began giving out awards, SAG, the DGA, and the PGA have been unanimous 6 times, and 5 times that film has gone on to win Best Picture.
There it is.
And before that, if you go back to 1989, when the Producers Guild began giving out awards, when they and the DGA were the only games in town, they agreed another 4 times. And every time that film went on to win the Oscar. So in the last 20 years, 10 films have swept all the pre-Oscar awards in the guilds, and 9 times they've won Best Picture. The only exception is Apollo 13.
as I keep saying, you cannot ignore this kind of pattern, but at the same time, there are times when the Academy just goes its own willful way. You know, and I'm not going to say that they're not going to vote for the King's Speech, but for example, just because Hooper won the DGA and the King's Speech is going to win probably Best Picture doesn't mean that Hooper's going to win, you know, Best Director necessarily.
Let's talk about that.
In fact, the DGA award is a better predictor for Best Picture than it is for Best Director.
Correct. Absolutely correct. The other thing that's interesting is I think that what happens, and I've been looking at this sort of carefully lately just to see how it could play out. For example, True Grit is another film that is very popular, and it got 10 nominations. And that part of that is because, like Inception, it's a big movie, and it has scale and scope and gorgeous vistas and period costumes and all that kind of thing.
And it's got an actress in the 14-year-old Halle Steinfeld who got nominated for Best Supporting Actress rather than Best Actress.
I have no problem with that. I think she's a newcomer and, you know, this has been debated and I see that they went with that. But I think she has a chance to win Best Supporting Actress. What do you guys think?
Absolutely. Because they love that movie, like you say. Well, it could also be Helena Bonham Carter. I think the clear indicator that King's Speech will win is if Helena Bonham Carter or Jeffrey Rush prove an upset in the supporting actor categories.
That's a good point. I mean, I don't actually – I think that what I was starting to say is that I think they might take all the films that they love and parcel them out.
I think that actually happens.
Categories. I think they definitely do that. And so if you were to pick out what could True Grit win? Well, it's not going to win picture because No Country for Old Men already did. It's not going to win best actor because Jeff Bridges just won. So, I mean, that doesn't mean
best
it can't happen, but it's unlikely to happen because Firth is going to win. Exactly. They're going to get cinematography. And I'm thinking maybe Haley Steinfeld.
Yeah. They love to crown a little girl as a new star, don't they?
I think they do, and she's quite. So that's the other part. You know, The Fighter could get, you know, Christian Bale and then, you know, and possibly Melissa Leo. I mean, she seems to be the leader right now. But
well, Melissa Leo won for The Fighter at the SAG Awards, Best Supporting Actress, and Christian Bale did win for The Fighter for Best Supporting Actor. But I wonder, Natalie Portman, who won the Golden Globe for her performance in Black Swan, and then again won at the SAG Awards for the same role. I wonder if the Academy will kind of turn to Annette Bening and say, okay, it's your year to win for The Kids Are All Right.
It's between those two. We have to give Natalie Portman a great deal of credit. She went on point. She trained. It's the best performance of her career. And she's looking very sweet and Madonna-like, you know, with her pregnancy. But I don't think I think Annette Bening is going to play best with the older Academy voters, and I think that's a factor that can't be ignored.
It just doesn't feel like a year where she's getting the attention and the love, though, particularly.
Well, the other factor there is that she's not necessarily the kind of actress who goes out and tub thumps. You know, she did go up to Santa Barbara this weekend, and she had a good tribute, but it wasn't the best interview possible for her. You know, when Sandra Bullock did it, it was, you just felt the electricity in the air. She was so fabulous. And Annette is more reserved. She's just not one of those people who sells herself, you know, comfortably, I would say. That could be a factor.
Well, Anne, thank you very much for taking the time out, not only to talk about the DGA and SAG Awards, but of course also Sundance. I hope you had a good time up there.
And I hope I catch up with some of the movies I missed.
Indeed. Do you think that some of those films might appear at another film festival in the south of France in, say, May?
And the other one that I understand is going to pick up a few of them is South by Southwest as well. Janet Pearson usually puts in about 12, and she was looking at everything. So I'm looking forward to catching up with some of them there. And you're absolutely right, Cannes. And if not that, the ones that are going to be held over for real award consideration will be seen in the fall.
And since 27 of them we know were picked up already, you know, they'll be at your local theater.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you. Do we need to come out of that?
Well, we have a fake outro,
which was
the music one. Well, from movies to music, we could do one if you want.
No, I think we should just leave it as is, don't you?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. I'm going to get started editing.
Unless you thought the music one should be cut and you wanted to do an intro to television in case you wanted to have that option. I don't know how exciting the music stuff was.
You're right. Do you want to outro us?
Yeah.
We'll skip the music entirely. We can...
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to say, well, that was nice. Yeah. And then what's our TV stuff?
Netflix.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay.
It's more like digital, really.
Right, but it's... Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was great, Evan, to catch us up on the films at Sundance. I look forward to seeing her at Cannes.
Well, yeah, and you probably can look forward to seeing some of those films that appeared at this year's Sundance Film Festivals, not only at Cannes, but who knows, you might see them on Netflix soon.
What?
Yeah, do you want to tell us what Netflix is doing?
Well, Netflix is throwing down the gauntlet, basically. HBO is part of the Time Warner company, of course, and they have always had sort of the rights to Warner Brothers films. They pay for them, and they probably pay a fair market value because Warner Brothers has to get a fair market value, or all the directors and people who are involved in those movies will sue them for not making as much money as they should off the movies that they make.
Well, which has happened in the past. I mean, David Duchovny.
Absolutely. There's all sorts of conflicts of interest that come up. And so companies really do have to look for fair market value. And Netflix has thrown down the gauntlet to say they're a big player. They want to go after the Warner Brothers films. They're going to challenge HBO. And at the very least, they're going to make HBO pay more money. So no matter what, they are just, you know, throwing their hat in the ring for any big film library that comes up. They want to get the rights to new movies coming from any major studio. They're going to pay top dollar. They're throwing their weight around, and they're, you know, letting Warner Brothers and HBO know in advance, hey, baby, we're players. So the worst case scenario is that they make HBO pay up, and that leaves more room for them in other areas. If HBO has to pay more for Warner Brothers, they have less money to pay for other studio films, and therefore Netflix can gain in that area. So it's win-win for them.
Well, HBO's deal with Time Warner is in effect until about 2014. So this wouldn't be an immediate thing. Even if Netflix won the auction there, it's not really an auction, but even if they cut a deal with Warner Brothers, it's not going to take effect until about 2015.
And of course, theatrical films are still an important part of the pay cable channels like HBO and Showtime, but I have to think that they're less and less important as time goes on.
Well, Netflix is pretty big. I mean, they are the largest, I guess, DVD by mail and now streaming I don't know what you would call them, company? I guess.
Yeah, well, they've gone ahead of Blockbuster, but now they're looking at some competition coming over their, you know, over in their rearview mirror.
Well, yeah, supposedly. I mean, Engadget on Sunday, I believe, had a little post about Amazon rolling out unlimited video streaming for subscribers to its Prime service. And Prime is a service that Amazon offers that allows for two-day delivery. So everybody that subscribes to Prime, which is about $80 a year, can order anything, or at least things that are Prime-enabled, if you
will.
Right,
but most things on Amazon, if you're a Prime member, shipping is free.
Most things,
I think that's the appeal for people. It doesn't have the days or whatever. If they're ordering a horse, of course, it'll take longer. But basically, shipping is free.
Right, and it takes 2 days. So,
well, it depends. I mean, like you say, it might be something that's not available right away, but you get it for free whenever it arrives.
Right, in 2 days.
Well, I'm not a member of Amazon Prime, though I have friends who are. If they're just going to add this new service...
Did we even say what the new service was? Shouldn't we say, hey, the new service is...
I thought you did. Please go ahead.
The new service, supposedly, is... I guess we did kind of say unlimited video streaming. One of Amazon's video-on-demand customers was poking around the site the other day and captured a screenshot which made it look as if they were going to offer Amazon Prime Video to subscribers, and then all of a sudden the button was gone after he refreshed his screen. So now there's all these rumors that Amazon is getting into the movie and video streaming business.
Well, it's certainly something they would have a button for and want to be preparing for, because they have a library, and if they can provide video streaming of some of their catalog, they're going to have to get in that business because it's a growing part of the industry. So it would be good for Netflix to have competition. I don't know who else would be doing this. I mean, you've got video demand through your cable subscribers. iTunes really just does downloading.
I think iTunes is going to get into this. Well, I should say Apple is going to get into this through iTunes.
Mm-hmm. They're not yet, though, right?
No, they are not streaming yet. Of course, you can download certain movies and television shows if you pay for them. I think you can also, of course, you can also rent, actually.
Yes, you can rent now through iTunes. And, when Netflix has the right to rent movies via video streaming, that's not exclusive, correct? I mean, you wouldn't want to limit it if you were like Warner Brothers. You want everybody to be able to pay for your movies and be able to rent them from wherever they go, whether it's iTunes or Netflix or Amazon. So I assume the same would be true for video streaming.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I think it depends on the deal that Netflix cuts, but in most cases, in for this type of deal, it would not be exclusive.
Right. That's what I would hope. So that's great for people. I'm not a member of Amazon Prime, but boy, that would be a huge new thing. Depending on how big their library is, that'd be a pretty nice new offering. It would be a big deal.
Oh yeah, I guess it would be a big deal. I'm a member of Amazon's Prime. I get my stuff in 2 days. That's basically what I mean to say. But since you say it's a big deal, that must mean that it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we take a look at the week's top headlines and figure out whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story today, more advertisers are running away from skins. Taco Bell, Subway, Wrigley, General Motors, Schick Hydro. What the heck is that?
It's a razor.
Oh, okay. H&R Block, they've all distanced themselves from the Randy hit series on MTV, even though the show's content has been absolutely clear for literally years. It's very much a remake of the UK series that played there in the UK and on the cable channel BBC America since 2007. No one was caught unaware by this, but for some reason, the PTC, and Michael, what does that stand for?
The Parents Television Council.
Yes, our favorite organization. And they've been in a panic over whether the show was technically or is technically kiddie porn. And they have sent advertisers racing away from the show. The second episode was filled with in-house MTV ads and even a cheapo ad for a cream to banish stretch marks. Ooh, let me make a note of that. Now, this might make sense for MTV's reality show Teen Mom, but clearly it looks out of place on skins. Oh, and there were also a ton of movie ads. So the PTC has a lot of major corporations it can harass. Is the continued panic a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's becoming a big deal. People say, oh, all publicity is good publicity. But this really has been a bit of a disaster for MTV. They need more original fictional programming. They've got too much reality. I think they've been totally blindsided by this, and they're trying to get ahead of the curve and not get people freaking out. But they certainly haven't changed much of the show. I saw episode 3 on Monday night, and it begins with a teenager who's taken a Viagra-like drug, and he wakes up with an erection and walks around the house for like 20 minutes with an erection. And yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, half the show. He's got this erection very, very visibly, and all his friends are hanging around and joking and laughing about it. I mean, they're not shying away from the content, that's for sure.
Could the King's Speech still clean up its act? Blue Valentine won its MPAA battle and avoided an NC-17 rating. But the King's Speech is stuck with an R, despite widespread mockery of such a decision over the use of some profanity in a humorous manner during a therapy session. Now, there are rumors that Harvey Weinstein wants to recut the film to gain a PG-13 audience and not leave money on the table. Jeffrey Rush objects, and The Hollywood Reporter says Weinstein won't do so unless director Tom Hooper signs off. So a movie that, in its current form, is the frontrunner to win Best Picture and a box office success might still be chopped down to bring in more families and school bookings. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I'll say it's a big whoop because I'm assuming it won't happen. It's idiotic. It's not going to help the movie at the box office whatsoever. There is nobody 14 or 15 years old who's dying to see this movie that wouldn't be taken by their parents anyway. So it's just ridiculous. And the idea that schools are going to take groups of kids to see the King's Speech as if it's some historical education, it's just ridiculous. It would be bad. It would be bad artistically and look bad for the film and look bad commercially and be a waste of money and time. So hopefully Harvey Weinstein won't be that stupid.
Well, I can't imagine how they would recut that film because that was such an instrumental part of the film.
Yeah, it's insane. It's ridiculous. It would be – you'd be gutting one of the high points of the film. Jeffrey Rush suggested maybe bleeps as the best case scenario for doing something like that because there's no other way to deal with it. But it would just be moronic. There is nobody under 16 who's waiting to see this movie, not a one. So who are they cutting it for?
Right, and really the scene is Colin Firth playing the King of England, who has a speech impediment, is in a speech therapy session with Jeffrey Rush, and he says, well, look, use some profane words because you don't stutter when you say profane words.
And I never curse when I say four-letter words either.
You never curse when you say four-letter words? What?
I never stumble when I curse. You're right.
Okay. Charlie Sheen continues to provide more drama off camera than he ever did on. Sheen entered the hospital with quote-unquote stomach pain, though the tabloids soon had stories of sexual romps. Then Sheen re-entered rehab, and the top-rated sitcom Two and a Half Men went on indefinite hiatus. If the show finally shuts down permanently, it could cost CBS literally hundreds of millions of dollars in lost revenue. It generated $155 million last season alone. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, when you're talking about $155 million, it's definitely a big deal. This is a rare collapse of a star in the midst of such a big hit TV show. I can't remember the last time anything ever like this happened. I mean, you've had secondary actors or people on a show have to leave or step aside or whatever, but to have the star and have the show shut down, this is just, it's very sad. It's unbelievable. And it's a disaster for CBS. It's their number one sitcom.
Number one sitcom or not, there will always be a sitcom that will come along and replace it at some point. But really, you know, there's a human being involved here. And, you know, yes, there are stories of sexual romps. I heard a story that he was laughing too hard and his hernia ruptured. And so that's why he went to the hospital. But, you know, really, it is a human being.
He wouldn't enter rehab because of that.
No, I would
have. He's gone back into rehab. He's clearly screwed up again. And regardless of the, you know, everybody wants to, oh, let's keep a human face in this. You know what? There are hundreds of people who work on this show. So when you talk about this show shutting down, that's hundreds of people who are out of work. So it's not just him. It's a lot of people. And if this show shuts down, it hurts them, hurts the network, it hurts stockholders. I mean, there's a lot of people affected by this, not just Charlie Sheen. So let's not make this all, you know, this guy's been given 100 chances by the world. And he's clearly messed up, and I feel sorry for him. But you know, he's every opportunity in the world to make himself better, and it's not easy. Maybe they shouldn't have rushed him back to work. Maybe they shouldn't have him in the show anymore. Who knows what's best for him, but it's a disaster for the show and the network.
Well, without him, what would it be, like One and a Half Men?
Exactly.
And besides, isn't that kid like 20 now? So shouldn't it be Three Men?
Yeah, it's long in the tooth, but it's still the number one sitcom in the country.
Well, hopefully for Charlie Sheen, he'll be able to kick his demons.
Yeah, and hopefully for the hundreds of other people who work on the show, they'll be able to get back to work.
First, it was Will Smith, the Fresh Prince. Then his son Jaden starred in the massive hit remake of The Karate Kid. Up next, what about daughter Willow Smith? Well, her dad has formed a production company with Jay-Z, and one of the first projects on their to-do list is a new film version of the musical Annie starring Willow. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. A child actor gets job. The child of Will Smith gets film role. This is even less of a surprise, but it makes sense since I think Jay-Z had a hit sampling Hard Knock Life from the musical Annie. So it makes perfect sense that he'd be involved in a new movie reboot of the story.
Well, and of course, Will Smith has had a production company called Overbrook for quite some time. In fact, we spoke to Franklin Leonard, who works. He's one of the development executives at Overbrook.
That's right. And he does the annual blacklist of the best unproduced screenplays.
That's right. But, you know, I think the big deal, if there is one in this story, is that Jay-Z is getting into making movies, the hip-hop and rap star.
Well, they were both involved in the Broadway show Fela, about Fela Kuti, the great African artist, sort of the African Bob Marley, a huge political and cultural figure in Africa. That's been a modest success on Broadway. It's run a while and gotten great reviews. It's not been a huge hit at the box office, but it's done well. I think they've made their money back, which is a big accomplishment on Broadway. So I think their working together on that has led them to the movies.
So Jon Stewart and Conan O'Brien have been facing off for weeks now, and we want to know who the winner is. Would you believe it's George Lopez? Stewart is number one in basic cable with 1.56 million viewers to Conan's 1.12 million. Colbert is right behind Conan with 1.1 million. More surprisingly, Stewart is up 9% over its ratings in January of 2010, but Conan is down compared to Lopez 1 year ago. So is Conan's early lag a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. I should clarify that these numbers are about late night talk shows. We're not talking about all the syndicated shows and reruns of sitcoms that are airing in late night. But it's a big deal. And, you know, they certainly expect him to be ahead of George Lopez at this point. He had as much attention as you could ask for. But yeah, talk shows are a long race. They're marathons, you know. Wait to see where he is a year and a half in, 2 years in. You have a much better idea. But it's pretty – I was a little stunned, I must admit.
Hey, if you've got an animated film about birds in Rio and you want to promote it, what better way than the red-hot video game Angry Birds? That's the thinking of Fox, which is promoting the comedy Rio, which stars the voices of Jesse Eisenberg and Anne Hathaway as two macaws who fall in love during Carnival.
Carnival.
Carnival, okay. The Comedy Rio will get an Angry Birds tie-in with a new branded version of Angry Birds leading up to the film's release in April. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's definitely a big whoop. The game's been out for a long time. It's not going to gain any new attention because of this. It's a clever little marketing tie-in, but that's it.
Have you played that game?
I have.
It's a game on the iPhone and the iPad and Android phones. It's incredibly addictive where you like fling birds at, I don't know, at pigs. I don't really get the connection, but...
It's very satisfying because the physics are real and accurate. So if you, the way things fall and collapse is, it's somehow very satisfying. It's a very clever little thing, and I try to avoid it as much as possible.
Indeed, it's a great time waster. Well, not a great time waster. It is a time waster.
Yeah.
Spartacus: Gods of the Arena debuted on Starz to excellent numbers, 1.1 million viewers, just a tad under the first season finale of 1.2 million. Add in another 753,000 later that night for a rerun, and you've got a total of about 1.9 million people for the hyped-up prequel. Michael, is the strong opening a big deal or a big whoop for Spartacus?
It's a big deal for Starz. You know, every channel needs original programming, and obviously 1.9 million wouldn't get you would get you canceled if you were on a major network. But you add up all the hundreds of cable channels, and getting 1 million, 2 million people to come to your network and sample your show and know that your network exists is really important. And this show has been cursed. You know, they had a star, they launched season one, he got cancer, he's very ill, he's off the show. They did this prequel because he was unavailable. Now it's doing well, and they've now recast the lead role, and they're going to go ahead with season three. So despite all the turmoil, they're still working and making the show, and people are still tuning in. So it's definitely a big deal because you need original programming.
Camelot is coming to cable. Actually, that's confusing because a new TV series based on the King Arthur legend is coming to Starz. But we're talking about President John F. Kennedy's Camelot. The miniseries about his family that was made and then dropped by the History Channel was shopped around to Showtime and FX and Starz, all of whom passed. But now it's been snapped up by the Reels Channel. A basic cable network in Albuquerque plans to premiere the miniseries on April 3rd after a big ad campaign to bring attention to their channel and hopefully get more cable companies to sign up. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal to show how far the miniseries has fallen. I wasn't even sure if I got Reels Channel on my cable, and I had to go search it out. I actually do have it, not that I've ever been there, but it does exist on Time Warner Cable at least, and they're hoping Cox and some other cable companies will pick them up if they can gain a little attention. And that's what Starz did. They had a big miniseries, Pillars of the Earth, and then they segued to original programming, so I'm sure we can look for Reels Channel to try and come up with some new series pretty soon.
Ricky Gervais? Back at the Golden Globes? We told you that with a ton of press and ratings on the rise, that the Hollywood Foreign Press Association would decide Gervais wasn't so nasty after all. And indeed, he claims that they've already asked him to come back for a third year as host. But joking about his two TV series that he ended after brief runs, Gervais blogged, "You know me, two seasons is enough." Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop if you listen to Showbiz, because we told you, you know what? They may be all angry at him right now, but if the ratings go up and all the attention he got, they'd be fools not to ask him back. So I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah, it just goes to show you what whores they are.
Exactly. I love this quote that was in the Hollywood Reporter. Of course, the president of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association was really annoyed. And at the night of the program, he said Ricky Gervais, quote, definitely crossed the line. But now a rep for the org said, you know, we love this show. It was one of the best we've ever had. And we were pleased. Of course they were. It got them attention, tons of attention.
You mean he crossed the line into fantastic?
Exactly.
Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and brings us right along into Inside Baseball. And I don't even know where to begin this week, Michael. I mean, you have so much book news here. I'm just going to turn it over to you and you can fill us all in on borders and ebooks and, well, everything publishing.
Right. So we'll have all these links in our show notes. You can go and check out the notes that we have or go to the original stories to read a lot more. The first story is about borders, which is along with Barnes & Noble, one of the two biggest bookstore chains in the country. They are going down for the count. They've been trying to reorganize. They've got a ton of debt. They've been going to creditors again and again saying, what can we work out? What can we do? Here's our idea. And creditors have said, uh-uh, we don't buy it. Not happening. And finally, late Sunday night, that's when it was, Borders said it just wouldn't be making its January payments to all the people that it owes money.
Which they kind of said in December about December. So
that's right. And they kept trying to have meetings and meeting. And every time they'd come up with a plan, people would say they just didn't buy it. They didn't believe Borders really had a plan for the future. They felt like they were just trying to tread water and delay the inevitable. And now the inevitable is happening. They're going to have to file for bankruptcy, probably. The question is, will it be under Chapter 11, where they can reorganize and deal with their debt and stay in business? Or will it be under Chapter 7, which would mean liquidating the company? So Borders could very much go under.
Well, I think they do have a plan. I think Borders has a plan. Their plan is to not pay you.
That's right. I have a gift card from Borders. Unfortunately, it's $80. And this is the last thing they want to hear. But I have a gift card and I'm going online to use it immediately because I'm desperate. I'm worried they'll be gone. I'm serious. And,
They still have to honor the gift card
if they go out of business. I could you know, be part of a settlement thing. But yeah, right. They go out of business. I'm screwed. And you know what? I went on their website and all the things I want, they don't have. All these music albums that I was looking for, or box sets or things. They don't have, and they cost a lot.
Wait, you wanted to buy a thing?
I wanted to buy thing one and thing two, and from the Dr. Seuss books. Stuff that they had was cheaper on Amazon or cheaper at Barnes & Noble, and I'm really annoyed.
That's part of the problem, don't you think? It's cheaper just about anywhere but Borders.
Well, yeah, because they can't make deals anymore because they're in such bad hot water. It's a vicious cycle. So it's very sad to see, but they are possibly going under. And, you know, like I said before, Barnes & Noble just had their flagship store in New York shut down. The publishing industry is just beginning to hit a tsunami of epic proportions.
Well, I wonder if they go out of business, whether they will continue to send me 5 emails a day about their specials.
Oh, I know. I somehow got on that list and it took me days to get off of it. But, you know, the publishing industry is being roiled by changes. You heard a lot about that at the Digital Book World, which is a convention for the industry that took place this January. And it was filled with a ton of fascinating tidbits about where the book industry is going right now. One of the big things was about digital itself. How big will it become? The publishing industry is about $20 billion a year in the U.S.
Digital is less than 10% of that right now.
That's right. And yeah. On several panels that they had, almost all the industry experts agree that within 3 years that the major publishing houses expect half of their revenue to come from digital. Half.
Didn't Amazon report recently that their Kindle books were outselling either hardcovers or paperbacks? I can't remember which.
Well, the ebook format on Amazon is now their number one format. They're outselling paperbacks, which is their number two format, and paperbacks grew over last year. And you may wonder why paperback sales grew on Amazon. That's because you can't find them in bookstores. It's true, and I've tried to do it. So Amazon is selling the Kindle in 100 countries. Kindle customers are avid book buyers, of course, and they're snapping up books a ton. And for every 100 books Amazon sells print-wise, they're selling 115 books as ebooks. So you wonder, well, what do these numbers mean? What do these figures mean? Amazon is sometimes a little tight-fisted with their data. But they did make clear that this is total sales.
Well, they're not
sales.
So tight-fisted. They mentioned that they made $10 billion last quarter.
Right. But they made clear that these are total sales for books. You might have thought maybe they were comparing books that were available as both ebooks and print books. But in fact, they're selling for every book that they sell print-wise, no matter what edition, they're selling 115 ebooks. Now, most books are not available in ebook yet. New releases are and bestsellers, but there are a lot of older titles that are not available as ebooks. So they're not saying, if it's available in ebook, we tend to sell more. No, they're saying, no matter what, we're selling more ebooks than regular books. So that's a big change, and it's part of this big, big trend. At Random House, they say digital is already outselling print in certain categories. They didn't detail what those categories were. But everybody's talking about the switch to digital and what it means and how to handle it. It's already happened. Random House, in certain categories, is selling more ebooks than print books. Amazon is selling more ebooks than print books overall. It's their number one format. Of course, Amazon is the home of the Kindle, so you'd expect them to flourish with ebooks most of all. But it's unbelievable.
Well, leave it to our never-ending love of gadgets to turn us all into readers again, or at the very least, digital book collectors.
That's right. And libraries are confused because libraries have always been a repository for our culture. When books go out of print, you can find them at the library. They have them. They preserve them. They share them. They make them available to scholars.
I'm sorry. What is this place you're talking about?
It's called a library. And they're very confused.
How do you spell that? Hold on. I'm going to write that down.
They're not sure what's going to happen and how they'll be able to continue in that role when all they're getting are ebooks. They don't even have the rights really to keep an ebook. You know, I mean, they just license the right to share it. So that's very confusing. And libraries are very confused about what to do. One person who was there had a panel discussion called Libraries Are Screwed.
Let's just cut to the chase. We don't need to go to the panel.
Yeah. And one of the more interesting areas are kids' books, specifically really picture books is what we're talking about. And there's a ton of creativity and ideas going on there, a little too much in my mind. But all the companies that have like brands like Dr. Seuss and Sesame Street and Winnie the Pooh are convinced that there's a ton of potential in children's books as ebooks.
You know, I think if you were to ask me, I would say that that Dr. Seuss and that Winnie the Pooh guy, they've got a future, in my opinion. That's just me talking.
Well, they're not going anywhere as brands, but specifically what these people think is not just taking a picture book and making it available on an iPad, but they're talking about taking a book and adding in tons of dynamic, interactive, multimedia content. You know, they think video, audio, games, you name it. I think they're scared that kids will get bored if they have to just read a book online. And the sort of slogan that they have is that they're going to create books you can play and games you can read. They're just obsessed with, and you know, in my mind, it's like, you know, relax. Some things are meant to be multimedia. Some things are meant to be games. Some things are meant to be half-hour TV specials like Cat in the Hat. But some things work as just picture books. But this is a huge change in the industry. Again, they expect in a few years, half of all their revenue will come from ebooks. You know what that means? That bookstores, by and large, will have their revenue drop by 50%. They're not the ones who are going to be making the sales. Yes, Barnes & Noble
And I'm just going to assume that what you're saying there is that's kind of important, that they're losing 50% of their revenue. That seems like a big deal. Not that we're back on that segment, but it seems...
I mean, Amazon...
And I hope my sarcasm is coming through here, because if it's not, Google, then people are going to think I'm an idiot.
And Google is working with a lot of independent booksellers because they don't expect everyone to come to their website. They expect passionate book people to go to their local independent bookstore's website to buy ebooks. And that could happen. But the big chains, they're going to get hit really hard. And even if they don't drop 50%, a lot of bookstores are going to lose 30% of their business, 40%. No matter what they gain in ebooks, they're going to lose a lot of business and a lot of bookstores are going to be wiped out.
Well, you know who's not losing a lot of business? Coachella. We talked about it last week, and we have an email from a listener here who pointed us to a story, and he writes, "Hey kids, that is what we're supposed to call you, right? I just listened to last week's episode in which you had Ann Powers from the LA Times talk about this year's Coachella Music and Arts Festival. I thought the conversation with Ann was really great and couldn't help but recall it when I read what some people are willing to do, literally, to score a 3-day pass. Apparently, the festival sold out by Tuesday of last week, leaving some hopeful attendees without passes." Yeah, hopeful, but procrastinators. But anyway, the Daily Swarm links to a story in which a woman is offering her lascivious services in exchange for a ticket to the festival. Besides the sexual favors, she's even willing to throw in $400. Whoa. Here's a link to the story. So we have a link to the story here. Love the show. Keep up the good work. Andy Torres from Toronto, Canada.
Well, thanks for responding, Andy. I hope he has his ticket in hand. Well, he's in Toronto, but I don't know if he does. But good on you.
People,
that's a popular festival.
People travel to it from all over the world, just like people listen to us from all over the world, and we thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or in your RSS reader. We hope you will go to either iTunes or the Zune Marketplace and review and rate the podcast. We certainly would appreciate it. You can find links to all of the stories we've discussed and ways to subscribe to the podcast on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to contact us. You can email us, just like Andy Torres did. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail. The number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael has a website. It's michaelgiltz.com, and he's on Twitter. You can look up his username, Michael Giltz. I'm on Twitter. My username is @Sperling, and you can find some of my writing at celluloidjunkie.com. I'd like to thank Ann Thompson for joining us. We'll have links to all of her work from Sundance in our show notes. Until next week, play nice.